Reading from the Yoga Sutras, Chapter 1, Text 17. Vitarka Vicharanandasmita Hupanugamat Sampragata. Sampragata Samadhi is accompanied by absorption with physical awareness, absorption with subtle awareness, absorption with bliss, and absorption with the sense of I-ness. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnananjana Salakaya Chaksurun Mutam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manovishtam Lapitam Yena Bhutale Shayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Sapadantikam Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyasya Kripa Shindu Bhayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Shivasade Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So greetings from New York. I'm at the Cornwall, New York, near Newburgh, at the home of the Revolves. If any of you are listening in the area, beginning Saturday at noon through Sunday at noon, we'll have the Kirtan Festival with... Also, should be some enlightening discussions by His Holiness Sri Dayananda Maharaj, Bhakti Vishwambar Madhav Maharaj, myself, Jayadvaita Swami. Of course, you're all welcome to come. And it'll be held here as it is every year. I just returned from... Moscow. I believe the last class was attempted from there. And basically just returned. I'm pretty okay. A little foggy because I just took a nap because technically speaking, the time change difference, this would be 5 in the morning. And I got back at JFK and then immediately came upstate. Just to share with you, it was such a wonderful experience. Sharing some of this knowledge, a lot of the things that I speak about but put into seminar forms, it's really edifying to see the response that people have. Well, just to tell a story, interesting how I came to Moscow. I was in Govardhan during Kartik, in the middle of Kartik, where I take a, almost like following the advice of the Yoga Sutras, if you want to transform the mind in a higher condition of well-being and a higher level of reflectiveness, then you practice meditation. And meditation means without stop and for a long time, and you have this wonderful effect on the mind, or the consciousness, the mind or the consciousness, actually. the mind and the consciousness. And, you know, at that particular time, I try to almost like give myself a present and I try to live my life for others, but to live your life for others, you have to spend some time with yourself. It's just like the different definitions of which is better, the japa meditation or the kirtan. And we know how much more absorbing that the kirtan can be when the meditation is accompanied by suitable rag, suitable music. In book I'm compiling together now, I just did one on japa meditation, I'll do one on kirtan and meditation, the mood and technique of Gaudiya Kirtan. And Akinchana Krishna Das is helping with that. He's interviewing some very serious kirtaniers in both Mayapur and Vrindavan. And some are elderly Bengalis who are not just musicians, but have absorbed the culture of kirtan. And one question we asked is you know, kirtan is so absorbing, why do also japa, silent or murmuring? One answer given by one elderly sadhu was that we do japa meditation to become fixed, to attain nishtha, because we count a certain amount of mala or rounds. Another elderly sadhu, and from my understanding, when this this kirtan interview will be transcribed and then edited, it'll be really wonderful. He said, well, japa means you spend some time alone with the name. There's some kind of intimacy there, which will also lead to some kind of special flavor. So I like to spend some time alone with the name. But a friend of mine was taking a tour of people from Moscow to India, people who had some cursory interest in Indian culture, as is very popular today. I think these people are mostly interested in astrology. My friend took him to Vrindavan, and then more than that, he took him to Govardhan. And I was in this room in the Kesha Bharti Maharaj's kind of monastery there with the mud walls. It's very mystical. And I got a phone call, and can we see? I said, okay, come over. They came over, and I spoke to these people, and they went around Govardhan, and then, which is, they went around half, which is 12 kilometers, and then 2 days later they did. And they came to see me. I gave a little talk about sacred space, and gave them a little guidance on how to approach this sacred walk, and I accompanied them. And really amazing, because holy places have their effect. There's a certain potency in these places. Just like fire burns, whether you understand it or not, it burns a child. You take some medicine, it has an effect, whether you know what you've taken. You take poison, it has an effect, whether you know it's poison or not. So, yeah, a holy place has a certain effect on consciousness. Many people can experience that. And these people had such an experience. Such an experience. They all became attached to Vrindavan and practically... most of them became Krishna bhaktas, devotees of Krishna, and who is the Lord of Vrindavan. and they soon invited me to Moscow, and on their loving persistence and the ticket that they sent, I went there, and it was organized just so nicely. It was really a wonderful experience. I mean, they set up lectures in the middle of the city, rented out a nice seminar room, charged something for the, I guess, the use of the room and perhaps paying my ticket or whatever it is. But 60 paying people came a day. They also videoed it. And it was really, really, really wonderful. This type of knowledge I spoke about, the psychology of karma. I spoke about the yoga of forgiveness. I spoke about yoga psychology, sacred space. So it's very, very edifying and helped me understand the way people in different cultures think and understand things. But it was very, very nice, and I'm also happy to be back here. Forgive me if I'm slightly unfocused. I don't know. I had a long flight today, but okay. Well, let's discuss this subject. This is 16, so up to verse 17. So up to verse 16, we got the full definition of what yoga means, and yoga means to restrain the fluctuations of the mind. And we kind of had this nice image that there's a pure state of the mind. The mind is antahkarana. It's an instrument that we use, and it's the instrument we use while entangled within this world to perceive and view this world. And there's a conception in yoga and all spiritual practices that reality is beautiful. The anxiety that we have, the suffering we have, is because we are not seeing very clearly what is there, because the instrument in which we are doing so is distorted. So we have that image of the instrument in its cleanest and purest state, matter's purest state, the state which matter is meant for, is called goodness. And when the instrument is in goodness, it becomes translucent and reflective. It's kind of you can actually perceive yourself. One quality of the self, when its awareness of itself is pure, when there's pure spiritual awareness, for one thing, we see that we're eternal. We can look through the mind, and through the mind, like a mirror which reflects an object, reflects a person which is looking in the mirror, we're looking through the mind, and through the mind, the pure state of goodness becomes reflective, and we see ourselves as eternal. When the mind is distorted, we get a distorted perception of ourselves. We get a perception of ourselves which is temporary, and therefore filled with duality and filled with fear. So the idea of yoga is to attain this pure, attain this pure state of the mind. And the distortions of the mind come from the vrittis, from the thoughts, especially the thoughts due to the lower modes of passion and ignorance. And you get it, looking through a distorted lens, looking through a distorted mirror, looking through a dirty mirror, You don't see, it cannot be used purely to see reality. So yoga is to prevent this distortion of the mind, which comes from the vrittis, or the fluctuations of the thought, which bring the mind from the state of pure goodness to the lower modes, the lower forms of passion and ignorance. When the mind is in the form of passion, this intense desire for activity leads to restlessness and misery. And when it's in the form of ignorance, the intense desire for no activity leads to a certain darkness in perception, and a certain hopelessness and depression. So he described this, and the last thing he described is Nirodha. We just finished that, and Nirodha means when the mind is restrained, and therefore the fluctuations of thoughts are restrained, and you come to that point of yoga where it's a you can actually still or quell the mind. And then he described, of course, in that section on the Nirodha, which we finished, how is that done? And it's done by practice, and it's done by detachment. So this is the most powerful factor influence in quelling the mind. This practice and this detachment. And the practice, this yetna, this practice is for the mind to become one pointed, the mind to become fixed for a long time and without any distraction. In other words, for this practice to work, you have to concentrate. You can't let the mind wander here and there. It means, one, the concentration you have to do for a long time, and it can't be, it's not just a long time, but you can't break that meditation. You can't be just, you can't like meditate and then look on something and meditate and then think of something, and you have to control the mind. To make that mind one pointed. And again, this practice of meditation, this practice of meditation, it's difficult. And that's why we already discussed that there are different preliminary things one could do to bring the mind to a reasonable degree of goodness and lucidity to come to the purest degree of lucidity and the purest degree of lucidity and goodness. And that's actually going to be described here when you come to the platform of samadhi. So and it's a strategy. It's a strategy because you can think right now. If again, when you deal with the psychology of the mind, it's to come to this pure platform of goodness, and these vrittis or thoughts distort the mind. So there's such a nice strategy in this psychological understanding of how the mind works that all these vrittis are flowing. And we can think of ourselves, I mean, just try to stop the mind. When you try to stop the mind, you see how many thoughts are coming from the mind due to these desires for either inactivity, let me sleep, let me do nothing, or intense activity. How many are coming? And this strategy of meditation, just fix the mind on just one thought, of any object, and then quell all the other myriad of thoughts that are coming. And if you can do that for some time, and if you have a practice of sadhana that does that for some time, even in the morning, the effect will be there. If one actually is able to meditate for some time, what it does is, because the mind is very malleable, it changes its form or nature very, very rapidly. So even in the morning, if you do that and just practice meditation, the vrittis are quelled to a certain degree, because you're neglecting all of these thoughts that will distort the mind, and you can move it into a higher form of inner well-being, a higher form of goodness that will carry for some time, even during the day. So that practice is there, and then we discussed the dispassion, and there was a little confusion at the end. I probably didn't, I have to say, didn't explain it as carefully. But there was two levels of dispassion. One level is a, let me see how I can put this, is is that one becomes detached from the objects of the senses, and every level of detachment indicates here a degree of disinterest in material things. But then there was a second level of renunciation, which it says is not only indifference to the sensual objects of the world, and it also said not of this world, but the sensual objects of heaven, you know, a higher promised level of sensual experience, which is generally the reward offered in many sacrifices and practices through the Vedas. Not only that, but a higher level of detachment stemming from indifference towards something more subtle, the primordial composition of matter. And that comes when there's a awareness of the soul, because the complete loss of interest can only take place when the yogi attains something superior. So one level of meditation is you can come to the point of indifference towards the sensual objects of the world, and there's something a little bit a higher level of detachment when there's a complete disinterest in material things to the root of material life. When one becomes aware of something superior, it means when the soul is embodying its true nature. And we know from Bhagavad Gita that the highest renunciation is always mentioned when there is some superior taste. Does she have any vartante niraharasya dehana visodasyam? When you have a higher taste, then there's you're enabled to have even a deeper disinterest. And I guess I think part of the confusion here, because I mean it just the statement higher is indifference to the gunas themselves. When you're the second level of renunciation, when you perceive the soul itself, I guess the difference is here, or the difficulty in understanding the difference is a lot of times these distinctions are very, very subtle, and I give you an example in the practice of devotional service. One of the levels that one attains is anartha nivritti. Anartha means to give up that which has no value to meditation. But that stage itself, it's almost not like, because there's stages of practicing devotional service. You first have faith, then you associate with people, then you adopt practices, then you give up things that have no value to meditation, then you become fixed. And when you become fixed, you start to get a very profound taste. That profound taste increases, and you have a certain kind of addiction, a spontaneity of attraction. It's no longer having to control the mind. The mind is spontaneously flowing towards service to God. But that the stage of anartha, although you can make classic divisions one stage or another, you know, getting rid of things which are valueless goes all the way up to even to the higher stage of bhava, where there's still subtle effects due to subtle, very subtle attachments due to the effect of in the Vaishnava tradition of Vaishnava aparadha, offending others. Somehow this lingering effect. It's almost kind of like, you know, here would be an object. You know, you clean a room very, very thoroughly, right? You clean it very thoroughly, but there's still some scent. Let's say that there was some contamination in the room. You know, you can smell sometimes in a place food, you can smell sometimes smoke. So you come and you clean the room very, very, very thoroughly, you know. And, you know, still there may be a faint contamination that's beyond just the external. It's almost seeping into the elements itself. Some spill, something is stale or moldy or something, just very, very subtle. So getting rid of things that are useless to devotional service, there's things that remain very, very subtle. And I think that's what's being discussed here. There becomes an indifference to sensual objects of the world. And then there's a higher level of detachment stemming from something a little bit more subtle. And one thing the commentators kind of warn us in this kind of thing, and especially in the verses that are to come, is that when it gets to this high level of detachment and samadhi, etc., it's almost kind of like a map, where the descriptions are guideposts, but the realizations of what it is will actually be realized when you're there, because the map may have different, like, little signs, X's and zeros, and say Cornwall or Newburgh or, you know, some small town or here, you know. So you look at a map, so it's kind of, the map is by someone who's actually experienced everything, and then he can make a guide by which you can experience something. So, the Yoga Sutras, it appears to me that that's one of the problems, that there's something very subtle experience, and there are these demarcations. And, again, it is a sutra. It has to be unpacked. And part of the realization of it is, kind of knowing what's coming. And knowing what's coming will be that there are these different subtle stages of kind of discrimination or renunciation, and just letting you know that it will be complete when there's even a detachment for not just essential objects, but the whole platform of existence within this world. And, you know, in the story that it gave that example of Jada Bhart. I just met Pradyumna before I went to Moscow, who's a great scholar. And He's studying a lot. He works in the UN, and he just has a resting place in the ashram on 25th First Avenue. The kind monks led by Yogya Purush, they just respect him so much, even though he's not a monk. They give him some kind of bed in their ashram in the hall. And then he goes to work, and he has his books there, and he actually basically just sleeps, leaves in the morning, comes back at night just to take rest. And he's studying that story of Jeddah Bart, and I didn't have enough time to talk to him, but he said it's a unique example. But what it exemplifies is the Jeddah Bart who's had that meditation, you know, who was at that stage of bhava. He was at a very, very high level of absorption in bhakti, and somehow became subtly distracted by compassion for a deer. The mother got killed. The deer cub was there. There was some kind of distraction in the meditation, and somehow dying. Yam yam bhapi smaram bhavam tajantyam te kalevram tam tam. Whatever you're thinking at the time, but that to that nature you'll go. And somehow gets born as this deer, but with this special remembrance because of the high attainment of meditation in the previous life. He remembers its previous life and stays in a, you know, an ashram of sadhus, just so the deer can hear all these spiritual subjects, and becomes at such a level of renunciation when the deer dies, remembering its previous birth, how it was Bhat Maharaj, and almost achieved the highest level of meditation. There was some subtle interest in the world, subtle interest in the world. The third birth, as this in the Brahmin family, Jeddah Bart, he's an avaduta, which means has such disinterest with the world that consciously makes, consciously exhibits antisocial behavior to keep aloof from there's no desire from everything in the world. There's just no desire for the world as it exists, basically. And that's a famous story. So anyway, we finished the final part of the definition, 16th verse, which is which is Nirodha. So So having discussed this general cessation of thought in the preceding verses, now he turns his attention to the two basic categories of samadhi, and that's the perfectional state, the state of consciousness where all thought has been stilled, and therefore the final goal of yoga. And it's divided into two levels of samadhi, or complete absorption, which is sampragyata and asampragyata. There's two levels of samadhi, and the first is being discussed here. So mechanical process of controlling the mind, we know in Ashtanga Yoga, you come to a level where you're able to meditate. It's called dharana. And then the meditation deepens. It's called dhyana. And then the meditation deepens, and it's called samadhi. Now remember, Ashtanga Yoga, all the stages of Ashtanga Yoga are increasing degrees of control of the mind, beginning with moral restraints. The beginning of controlling the mind is how you deal with others. The next stage of controlling the mind is how you deal with yourself. Then asana. Next stage of controlling the mind is that one can meditate without awareness of the body. Then pranayama. One can increase the meditation by breath control. Then pratyahara, you can actually kind of militantly prevent when you know the there's data coming from the different sense objects, and the mind is so trained that as soon as practically the sense objects are identified, one can shut down the the kind of basically the senses. You know, if you're so trained that any data that comes in through the senses, as soon as the senses touch that those objects, the senses shut off to perception of those objects. It's just like when you're meditating, and we may have this experience, because I do believe in one way or another, who's ever on this sangha is a meditator. When you have this type of meditation, you know, you all have the experience that you may be chanting in some place, and there's maybe a highway or some cars, and there's the faint sound. But if you're really meditating deeply, you don't hear that sound. It's not that the sound is not vibrating the ears, but you shut off the inner ear. So even though the vibration is there, you're not hearing it, and it's not affecting your meditation. Just now, like when I give this class, if I listen externally, there's a lot of children in this house, they're playing, the family is talking, it's a joint family of five brothers living together, their wives, their children, the parents are here. There's a lot happening out there. Now I can hear it, but if I become meditative on this, speaking about this subject matter, I don't hear it. So there's a stage of yoga where the concentration even deepens to the level that all the internal sense organs are shut off, so that even there is sound vibrating the ear, that sound doesn't register within the buddhi or the intelligence. So that's the stage of pratyahara. Then when you're achieving that, then you can have dharana, which means you can hold the meditation. If you're thinking of a particular, you're thinking of a candle or you're thinking of God, you can hold that in your mind for a prolonged period of time. When you start to do that, the real effects of meditation, of reshaping the form of the mind towards its pure state of sattva, by restricting all other thoughts, begins to have its effect. So you have dharana, and then jhana is when that meditation is even deeper, and samadhi is when there's such complete absorption that one can meditate or focus on one object, can focus on one object for an hour and 20 minutes without any cognizance of something outside. The stage before of jhana, it's this cognizance still of something outside. This cognizance of it, even though you're not particularly meditating on it. But there's some kind of cognizance of something outside. When there's samadhi, it's so deep, there's no cognizance. And it's a very, very wonderful thought that all meditators should take, is really trying to focus the mind and going deeper and deeper and deeper, and less and less cognizant of the outside world. You can see that in meditation. It's a way of going deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And you seem to distance yourself in cognizance from the external senses and the external objects of the senses. I'm saying because there's this talk outside, and it reminds me of a friend of mine who lived in India and worked in the Peace Corps in late 1960s, and came up to a realization why sometimes Indians are kind of loud, even in a normal tone of conversation, it seems to be a little bit louder than other people sometime. And he said that because it was basically, his experience was a rural community. So when you're in a rural community, you're always calling people from across the fields. That kind of stays with you. I'm hearing some normal conversation. Okay, so now here we've come to the point of, and there's going to be two types of samadhi, and sampragata samadhi and asampragata samadhi. And again, this is the yoga type of process. And here is when it gets a little bit different from the Vaishnav conception of samadhi. I'd have to look in the Bhakti Sandarbha where that's described. But in, I believe, sampragata samadhi, where there is awareness of objects, and that object is lila, the pastimes of God and his devotees, that's what flows within the mind, and that and that's perceived not with the material mind, but the spiritual senses of the soul. And that's a little bit different from the yoga process, as you'll see. But that type of samadhi is, the samadhi is, becomes an absorption in the pastimes of Krishna, which is considered the highest level of samadhi. And it comes to a point where it's not done through the material mind, but there's actual spiritual senses, that the soul has perception, and the soul can hear, and one becomes absorbed in that nature. So there's a little theological difference here. But here, representing the text, the higher samadhi here is a sampragata. Sampragata means you're at a very, very high level of absorption and meditation, and the mind is stilled, but it is done through the mind. And asampragata samadhi means that when you get through sampragata samadhi with the mind, in deeper and deeper and deeper stages of meditation, then at a particular time you become, the mind no longer becomes an instrument for awareness, but because the nature of the soul is to be aware, the soul becomes aware of itself only. It imbibes in its own self, and that in yoga is considered the highest level of samadhi. So sampragata, this type of trance, you still use the mind and an object of meditation. So that's sampragata. You use the mind and an object of meditation. And then asampragata is you no longer use the mind and any other object of meditation, and the soul, which is pure awareness, becomes just aware of itself. So here in this verse, sampragata samadhi, it's basically, and when I was reading the commentaries, it says, you know, don't get hung up by the translations. They're just guideposts given by meditators. But basically, the first one is called vitarka. And vitarka means, and then there's vichara. And vitarka means absorption with physical awareness. So you're absorbed in the physical object. You're meditating on that candle and you're in samadhi. That one thought, and the mind is focused exclusively on that, and there is no other thoughts. And you begin to get a very, very deep meditation of that. It's also described when one controls the mind like that. You'll see later in the Yoga Sutras it's mentioned that very mystical things happen. You start to become aware of the subtle sense object. There's one meditation where you're just meditating on the breath and the nose, and that becomes your singular meditation. And at a particular time, what happens is you go to a more subtle awareness, which is the subtle instrument of the senses. Not, it's true. There's a gross ear. I explain that right here. You're, it's vibrating, It's vibrating and you're hearing things, right? But you can shut that external ear off, and then there's, in other words, unless the internal ear is activated, you can't hear. So there is a, first there's a meditation externally. You're just meditating on the breath alone. And then by doing that, for a while, you come contact with the more subtle object, a subtle instrument of the senses. And I've even had people who went to Buddhistic retreats where, you know, for 10 days that you can't talk about anything, where, you know, you just shut off the senses, and they went for 10 days, and they actually experienced this. Because one person was telling me, I said, what happens? I was talking to this person that went, and they said, at a particular time breathing, you get a very sweet fragrance, a very mystical. And then when I read in the Yoga Sutras, it exactly says that. When you meditate on that, you achieve a certain stage where you get a kind of a subtle awareness. So it's accompanied with an absorption in physical awareness, then there's an absorption in subtle awareness, then it says an absorption with bliss, an absorption with a sense of I-ness. It's just different guideposts that the meditation kind of goes deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And different commentators explain this, but, you know, with some pragyata samadhi, that it still has support of the mind. You meditate on one thing and resist changing the mind to others. And the first one is something really more gross, and then it becomes more subtle. But you still have support of the mind. And then on pragyata samadhi, there's no support of the mind. You're just aware of the pure self. If I can give anything else to help understand this. Anyway, all the commentators just describe it in different ways of subtlety, but there's four stages there. And the third stage, for example, you transfer your awareness from the objects of the senses, that which is grasped, to the organs of the senses, which means the instruments of grasping. So that's one way to look at it. There's a meditation where it's just singular. You restrain from anything else but the object, that which is grasped. And then the meditation comes even deeper to the organs of the senses. You're meditating on that which is grasping from the sense objects to the instrument. And then the third stage, you transcended all objects, including the internal organs of cognition, and then the buddhi or the intelligence that's meditating inward, it gradually focuses on the soul itself, reflected through the mind. And it begins to reflect the consciousness of the soul back to itself. But it's still, even at the fourth stage, which is called, it's still connected to matter. And if there's minor differences between the commentators who are in the same tradition on their understanding of the metaphysical nature of the final two stages, so what to speak of us, but all commentators agree that this verse describes these refining one's awareness during consecutive stages of meditation, that through progressively more subtle states of cognition, finally to get this to be able to focus with the mind simply on the source of awareness itself, which is the soul, and so that's the you're meditating on that, and then finally. You're able not to even think of the mind itself, and you without any support, and that's the second verse. The other samadhi, asampragata, is preceded by cultivating the idea of terminating all thoughts in this state only. You know, there's no other support, and because the mind is empty of all thoughts, as Vyasa puts it, awareness. You have no other object to be aware of. You're only self-aware. And the final goal of yoga is attained. That's the school of yoga. And that's quite different from, at least that is quite different from Gaudiya Vaishnavism, because Gaudiya Vaishnavism believes that is actually, when you actually become aware of the soul itself has ability to perceive objects outside of itself, besides itself. It can actually meditate on reality as connected with God and feel that connection in terms of love. Okay. Anyway, I'm going to tell you the challenges here. These type of verses have commentaries that go into unlimited depth. Very difficult for me to even get through them in my schedule in a short week. So I'm just trying to extract the essence of it. And after we discuss this section, then it's going to really discuss the practice and the progressive stage of the practice and different stages of the Astanga Yoga and the benefits one gets from the perfection of all stages. And it becomes a little bit more relevant, but this is defining the goal. Okay, Hare Krishna. Mahamuni, are you there? Still?
Hare Bol, Marsh.
Okay, Hare Bol.
I had a couple questions, if that's okay.
Yeah, please.
The first one is super simple. It's like the other ones are maybe a bit more in-depth.
Well, let's go.
About samadhi consisting of the ability to remain in this fixed meditation for an hour and 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah, okay. Go ahead.
Different numbers, but sometimes I just wonder, where do they come from? And
I thought it was an interesting way to understand it, you know? Because it's not just yoga is you sit down in a pose, you know, and your mind wanders all over the place. There's a certain level, right, where it's yoga. There's a certain level where it, you know, it's beginning to work practically. It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like your practices or get to the stage where you can actually do something, you know. You know, even in the process of bhakti, we have one conception. We're doing sadhana, we're doing practice, you know, and that practice is trying to make the heart dependent on God, you know. And you know, when you become dependent on God and when you're yearning, you know, is sincere, that's real practice. Sometimes they say like that. Although you can't differentiate the you know, that it's not all practice, but there's a certain level, you know, and especially in this kind of meditation, which requires a certain lucidity of the mind. So I'll tell you, you know, I can't even quote a shastra. I'm going to tell you where I got that from. I was reading Mahanidhi Swami's book. I forgot something on chanting.
Yeah, the art of chanting. I think
the art of chanting, and that's my reference. And I don't even remember where he got it, but he got it from. I assumed he got it from some book or some meditation book, where some people actually put minutes on it. So without subscribing the particular minutes, to me the relevance is, you know, that there has to be some consistency for some time. And even when I do give myself, I give japa seminars, to discuss it in this terms, you know, gives people an inspiration. Even try to control the mind without any thought for 1 minute, you know. And unless you have some idea that real meditation is when you're fixed for a while, I don't think you even endeavor to do that.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. It's just sometimes when I hear numbers thrown out, I imagine a yogi sitting in a cave wondering if he's...
Yeah, guy with a stopwatch, right?
It seems a little weird to me.
I can understand the image that gives now that I've explain the reference, maybe it's more a little relevant. But the image is funny too, right? Because
yeah,
who's timing it,
your point,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, who's timing it? Is it like someone outside has said, okay, boom, you know, boom, you know?
Yeah,
and then the guy said, okay, wait, I thought of my girlfriend, you know, it's over, boom, you know? Okay, I got it. Yeah, go ahead.
They don't use the same number system we do, so it's funny that it fits the bars, you know?
Yeah, right.
Anyway,
okay. I got it. Yeah.
You framed it generally, which makes sense. It's got to be for a long time. That seems to
But I think it also points out the difficulty, right, in writing about these things, you know? Because how do you translate it? You know, it's trying to, you know, kind of communicate experience, you know. But there's the idea that the real understanding is when you're there. And I like the example of the map, you know.
Because
the map has a certain city, and, you know, and you can go through it in the map. And the map can get you there. But you can't experience what that highway's like or, you know, what that hotel is, or, you know, what the turnoff looks like, or what the throughway is, or what that city is like, you know. But there's a map, you know, this is a city of 500,000, and this is a city of 50,000, and this is a park that they have here, right? And this is the rest stop, you know. So you kind of get a way to get there, but you don't get a clear description until you're there. So go ahead. What else, Mooney?
Well, thank you. I appreciated, too, that you made a distinction between the details of this description and what we as theistic Vedantins or Vaishnavas do. Because have you ever read the book Ramanuja on the Yoga? I don't remember if...
You did give it to me, and I kind of remember it, you know, as one of those...
I just remember that Ramanuja basically accepts Ashtanga Yoga, but he rejects their notion of samadhi, which is...
Very interesting.
And so I think there may be...
I think it's important you to point that out simply for the fact that probably most listeners are in the, not all, but most listeners are in the that tradition. And that, yeah, so I guess that would have been, I'm going to write down my notes because it's an interesting thing to say, but I guess that's from my own experience and understanding, that's the conclusion I got. It's just a different perception of what that ultimate meditation is when you go through those practices. Because also in the descriptions of meditation in the path of bhakti, they divide the last three stages into four, actually. Dharana, Dhyan, Dhruvana, Smriti, and Samadhi. And the Dhruvana, Smriti becomes... There's a meditation on the pastimes of Radha and Krishna. And that's in the consciousness, and it's described like ghee or oil is flowing. The meditation is so deep that there's no break. It goes from one thing to another. But you're still cognizant that there's something else outside. And when you get to the samadhi, that absorption becomes so deep, they're not cognizant of the world. And therefore, they describe at that level of samadhi, it's very difficult socially to be in the world. Because you'll be meditating and relishing those pastimes. You'll be laughing hysterically or crying, you know. And the emotions of love of the soul will become so pronounced. And people will be seeing you doing that, but you're not cognizant that you're in the world. So it's interesting.
Yeah, and I think that also points to the real great division between what we're trying to do and what the yogis being depicted here are doing, in that for them, their ultimate awareness has, I don't know, to use a bit of philosophical jargon, it has no propositional content. That is to say, when they're in their higher levels of samadhi, they're not supposed to be getting any information from it.
Yeah.
But in our notion, we're getting information constantly from God, so to speak, right? It's So anyway, I thought that was an important kind of distinction.
That's really the distinction. And what's very interesting, especially for people who train in, you know, Gaudiya Vedanta, so to speak, we generally have a conception that there's only two conceptions of perfection, right? which is, you know, in perfection, it comes to a point of undifferentiated oneness, or you come to the point of realizing God and your relationship with God. And one is you realize you're God, basically. And that's our two basic distinctions. But here, in this type of yoga by Patanjali, when you come to Asampragata Samadhi, you become self-aware. There's no propositional content. You need these kind of words to explain it. But the understanding is he still believes there's God. Just not an awareness of relationship with God somehow, which I have no frame of reference to understand personally. And someone who's deep in that tradition would have to explain how that makes sense, because I have no standpoint to understand that. But without passing, you know, but just in trying to give the text as it is, without any prejudgment, before I make prejudgment that makes no sense, I'd like someone in the tradition to actually explain, you know. Well, they gave the example of like the sun, you know, that it's completely dependent on itself, you know, the sun rays are coming, so at that pure state, awareness is coming from the soul, you know? So you can just be constantly just aware of yourself. Anyway, interesting. Anything else?
I don't know. One other thing, I don't know.
Thanks, go ahead.
I think there's a real philosophical problem with their whole idea of samadhi, and I think in one sense I like it because I think it shows that views like the Gaudiya Vedanta view are better. But there's this whole description of Asampragata Samadhi, that in that it's the mind's pure awareness of itself, right? And it's not the
awareness
of the Buddha. Well, then how are there any yogis who remember that experience to tell us about it?
Clarify.
So if samskaras, right, memory traces,
yeah,
are supposed to be deposited in the buddhi,
yeah,
and if there's an experience of the pure self where the buddhi is not involved,
yeah,
then how are there any memory traces of it so these yogis can come back and tell us about it?
Well, one who's in that field of study would have to answer that. It's an interesting thing because a person who's one of the great scholars on the Yoga Sutras, I think his name is Swami Veda, and I know because Swami Veda gave my cousin, who used to be Susan Hecht or Mahasebha, sannyas. And, you know, her name is now Mahasebha Bharti, and that person gave it, so she knows it. And a godbrother of mine, who's a Sanskrit scholar, teaches Sanskrit in his dashram, you know? And in a very, because the person is a gentleman, this Swami Veda, and the Sanskrit scholar says, you know, he really knows kind of shit. He kind of asked him this kind of question, you know? And there was some answer that was kind of given, you know, some kind of analogy that was given, which didn't make sense to me. Yeah. But, you know, there's a, yeah, I guess I'd have to give them some credit maybe that they have some way to explain it, but I think the point, I mean, it seems like a valid argument, right? How is it explained? Because to explain something, you have the memory of something, and at that particular state, there's no support of the mind where the memories are placed, you know? So how is their memory of it? It's just like in fluctuations of the mind, one of the stages was this deep sleep, you know, where there's kind of a total ignorance, right? But, you know, but how do you know deep sleep exists? Because when you wake up, you remember it, you know? You remember somehow you had this state of consciousness, you know? So how do you... Okay, anyway, I like that. It's an important point. Yeah, what else?
What I like about it is I think that it leads one to go more towards a view that I think is the right one, that the self has inherent capacities of willing and experiencing and remembering. me is the number.
I personally, I'm presenting this, and but when it does get to the stage of samadhi, I definitely, obviously, because I'm a practitioner of another way of thought, you know, it doesn't make sense to me. But in fairness, as someone presenting their text,
I understand.
I guess I have to be a little objective and say, you know, I'd have to ask someone who is a follower of this path, you know. And I think it's a fact, except for the descriptions of samadhi, the whole text is completely relevant. You know, Sankhya, you know, stages of detachment, preparations from detachment, preparations for detachment. It's completely relevant, because basically to any particular path, because what Patanjali has done, again, he's not the creator of this yoga philosophy, but what Patanjali has done is Patanjali has kind of honed from all, you know, from the traditions of the time, the psychological process of controlling the mind, you know? So the only difference is his bent on the perfectional state. Okay.
I can bring, there's other things, but I you're giving me a lot of time. I can bring them up later or privately.
Well, keep them, because I, you know, somehow I'm surprised I went so long today, you know, which is, you know, I thought probably I'd end shorter, so I don't know what that exactly means, but, okay. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna?
As I hang up, sorry, I really appreciated your description of the eightfold process in terms of controlling the mind. I thought that really was very clear. So
you know what I liked today, which I thought was a new realization for me, was what pratyahara is in terms of internal and external sense organs. Because there's obviously an internal sense organ, because sometimes we don't hear even though the vibration is in the air. Okay, thank you, Muni. Okay. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. This is Gail.
Thank you. I, you know, knew you were out there somewhere. Okay. Yes. Thank you, Gail, for always being an ear.
Yeah, I have a class today. It was really, you know, I really appreciated your translating all these terms into terms that were more assimilatable, you know. Like Mahamuni said, you know, the way you described the different stages of concentration, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then the next class you could repeat the you know, the four stages of
yeah.
awareness, you know. I mean, I remember the last two, you know, the one that's dependent on the mind, the one that's not, you know, but the first two I forgot.
Well,
but anyway,
well,
I think
No. I'll just explain one thing. Those are the two levels of samadhi, support of the mind, no support of the mind. Then
uh-huh.
the one
okay,
that has
right.
support of the mind, there's four stages of support of the mind. Meditating on the external senses, meditating on the internal senses, and then two that are slightly different. Or meditating on that which can be grasped, meditating on the instruments which are grasping. You see, this is the first time I'm going through this subject, and really, honestly, my mode of learning is basically speaking on a subject. So the second time I speak about something, I understand it deeper, because different people I know, they grasp things in different ways. Some can just sit with books, you know, and just look at those books for 10 hours. I have to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of, class is kind of preparing me by, you know, I'm getting some good ideas of how this all works. And that's why I like to always go back and give a summary. Good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Gail, anything else?
Yeah, I think the other thing was what you just were just explaining to Mahamuni, because I was also wondering, you know, in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, you know, the end result of samadhi, I guess, is to be able to see Krishna's pastimes, you know.
Yeah.
And have love for him and see Krishna's pastimes, but you know, I mean, there's a point in the progression of awareness where we part ways with the yogis, you know, and so, you know, seeing Krishna's pastimes is our end, but you know, I wasn't so clear what is the end result of their, you know,
their end result. Their end result is when you're no longer dependent on the support of the mind, the soul becomes aware of itself, and that's the goal. Imbibing in your own nature. That's their goal.
And is there any relationship to Krishna in that?
No. No. There's
so
no
it's
talk
like
of it. There's absolutely no talk of it. Even though they believe in God, somehow or other, God becomes almost a vehicle to attain a particular state. And then you just imbibe in your own nature. And I don't know. It may become something like, you know, a light bulb, you know, reflects light greater than itself. So there's some kind of concept of merging also within it.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It sounds something like, you know, Brahman, you know.
It's something like Brahman realization. It is. But the understanding is that you're a soul that's different than God.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow or other, you experience where there's another school of thought where it's just like one soul realizing everything or something. This has a concept of many souls, you know, but each soul, but if it's like many light bulbs, you know, they share the light. You know, light is reflecting, they share the light. So there's some kind of expansion of consciousness that goes on. There's a lot of subtleties here, which I haven't had time to really wrap my mind around. But as I, in the preparation, I have read different things. So I read the whole books twice with the commentaries. I kind of remember certain concepts like that, you know. That there's some kind of analogy like a light or a candle. There's many candles, you know, they share in the same light, although they're different, you know. So there's mm-hmm. an example of the consciousness of the soul is not unlimited. It's not limited, you know. But still, there's a vishesh purush. There's a special purusha, a special soul which is different. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thanks, Gail, and I guess I'll see you this weekend?
Yes, Maharaj, thank you.
Okay, that's great. Okay, would anybody there like to say hello? One more friendly voice. Okay, well, thank you all. Bunchukalpa Drupya Sakura.